Tonight, our series, 2,000 Years of Jewish Odyssey, continues with a look at the 15th century, the 1400s, as always, we're sponsored by Becky Avi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas, Yona Ben Reb Aryeh Leib. The massacres of Spanish Jewry that began in 1391 and the expulsion of the Jews from France in 1394, except for parts of Provence, forced the Jews to turn eastward, where Jewish communities already existed, usually under the most dire and decrepit conditions. And we'll discuss that in a short while. If the 14th century was notable for its volcanic eruptions, like the Black Death and its accompanying persecutions, or like the Spanish pogroms in 1391, the 15th century stood out for the relentlessness of its persecutions. For Jews, the earth became very small, and Jews had no refuge at all. It was a literal fulfillment of what it says in the Tochacha, "Uvagoyim ohein lo sagia v'lo yamanoch l'kaf raglechem," that your feet will find no rest, the soles of your feet will not have any respite. Wherever Jews went, Jews found trouble, or trouble found Jews, and it was in almost every year. Jews were massacred in Syria and Prague in 1400. In 1401, 30 Jews were burnt at the stake in Switzerland in a blood libel, murdered in the desecration of the host libel in Salzburg in 1404, and so on and on and on. Almost every year, someplace on the globe found Jews under the knife. Jews in Corfu, in Salzburg, in Augsburg, Germany, in Arnhem, Netherlands, etc., were forced at one time or another to wear the special clothing or special colored badges. There was almost no country in the world in which Jews were not massacred on at least one occasion during the 15th century. Spain, Portugal, Algeria, Poland, Germany, Austria, Italy, France. The only place where Jews were not persecuted was a country like England, where Jews had already been expelled over a century before, so no Jews did a massacre. Also, in addition to the massacres, Jews were regularly expelled. The 15th century saw expulsions from Salzburg, from various cities in Germany and Switzerland, at century's end, of course, from Spain and Portugal. Except for the latter, Jews were regularly brought back in Germany, in Central and Eastern and Western Europe, only to be persecuted and driven out again just a few years after that. It was a very vicious and macabre cycle. In fact, tonight's the 4th of Iyar, so it's a commemoration. In 1464, on the 4th of Iyar, 545 years ago, 30 Jews were killed in Krakow. What was the reason? There really is no reason, or just the Christian-sponsored anti-Jewish violence. So how did we survive, and what did that survival entail? So as always, great Jews led the way, and Torah always manages to come to the surface, even in the most tumultuous era. The dominant figure among Jews of Ashkenaz, and in a very realistic sense, the person on whose shoulders we still rest today, was the Gadol in the early part of the 15th century, Rabbi Yaakov Molin, known to us as the Maharil. The Maharil was born and lived in Germany. He was a student of Rav Shalom of Neustadt, known as the Sar Shalom. The Maharil collected many of the minhagim of his Rebbe in his tshuvos. These practices were later compiled by the Maharil's Talmud, Reb Zalman, in what became known to us today as the Minhagei Maharil, the customs of the Maharil. And these customs of the Maharil are the foundation for the customs of the Jews of Ashkenaz, meaning most of us. A century later, the Rama would cite the Maharil hundreds of times in his glosses to the Shulchan Aruch. Now the Maharil was makpid not only on halacha and minhag, but also on nusach, on nigunim. Many of our melodies for the Yom Noraim date to the Maharil's time, if not early. He's very didactic about it. The Maharil was the Gadol Hador, as well as an eyewitness to the slaughter of Austrian Jews that took place just a few years before his death. Jews of Austria suffered during the Hussite Wars of the 1420s. There was a Christian sect followers of Jan Hus, who was a Czech, who was a forerunner of the Protestant Reformation that had challenged the Pope's authority. So when Hus was executed in 1415, war broke out between his followers and the Catholics. The war lasted for the better part of 20 years, and we suffered. Jews always suffered from unrest, because unrest gives the belligerents on both sides a chance to vent, and vent against Jews, especially if the war was not going well. So Maharil's prime Talmud was Rabbi Yaakov Weil, known as the Mahari Weil, who was a Rav in Germany as well, the main posek after the Maharil's death. He wrote a famous work on Shechita, as well as voluminous Shilas and Tshuvos. It was another important Rav, known to us until today. The work is still studied today. Rabbi Yisrael Israelein, 1390 to 1460. It was a Rav mainly in Austria, especially in Wiener Neustadt, where he headed the yeshiva. I should mention that the Maharil died in 1427, so the first quarter century was the Maharil's time, and the quarter century, or a little longer after that, was the Trumas HaDeshens. Rabbi Yisrael Israelein wrote that sefer called the Trumas HaDeshen, 354 Tshuvos, in Gematria Deshen. So that was the name, Trumas HaDeshen. And the Trumas HaDeshen was also a major source for the Ramah, and again, a sefer that we study from until today. Both the Maharil and the Trumas HaDeshen were the main teachers of Rabbi Yisrael Bruna, known as the Mahari Bruna, 1400 to 1480, who was the Rav in that town, today Brno, in Moravia, in the Czech Republic, until all of its Jews were expelled in 1451. The Mahari Bruna then moved to Regensburg, opened the yeshiva there, and that drew the ire of the head of another yeshiva in Regensburg, Rav Anshul, and that became a famous story that really has repercussions until today. He was challenged in his opening of this yeshiva, a rival yeshiva. This prompted tshuvos from both of his rebbeim. How they did it without entertaining the possibility of conflict escapes me. But the Trumas HaDeshen, Simon Kuf Chavov, and the tshuvos of the Mahari Weil in Kuf Nun Aleph, they both upheld the Mahari Bruna's right to open another yeshiva based on the famous principle in the Gemara, Kina Sofrim Tarbe Chochma, that the jealousy among scholars, that increases wisdom. So, the more jealousy, the more wisdom. No one has the right to tell someone you can't open a yeshiva or a shul, etc. There's no din of Hasagas Gvul in holy matters, usually, unless we say there is. But the Mahari Bruna was also arrested twice. Once to force the Jews to hand over a third of their wealth to Frederick III. Another time, a second time, when he was 74 years old, he was accused of a ritual murder of a Christian child. He, the Mahari Bruna, was sentenced to death, and he was only spared when the true murderer, a Christian, came forward and confessed. Wisely, the Mahari Bruna then left Germany, and he returned to Prague. In Prague itself, that great European capital, one renowned Rav in the 15th century was Rav Avigdor Kara, who got along famously with the local rulers. For the most part, in the 15th century, the Jews of Prague, except when there were pogroms, lived a decent life. Rav Avigdor Kara wrote many piyutim. He's best known today for one thing, and I would say one thing alone. In the old Jewish cemetery in Prague, where the Maharal is buried, the oldest tombstone is his. His grave with its tombstone dates back to 1439, the oldest surviving grave in the old Jewish cemetery in Prague. It was a tribute to these great Jews and many others that Torah survived in such an inhospitable and unwelcoming climate, and despite all the suffering, all the uncertainties of life itself, for reasons which really are unfathomable to us, Torah and Jewish life remained, and in a sense remained vibrant. Jews learned Torah, observed mitzvos, built yeshivos, worked and raised families. And despite all the challenges that took place and all the threats to Jews, in the 15th century, one nation came forward, actually provided more or less of a respite. I don't want to say refuge, but at least a respite for Jews, and that country was Italy. Italian Jews were typical of the vicissitudes of Jewish life in the 15th century. Italy wasn't a country really until the late 19th century. Italy then was divided into various city-states that were usually at war with each other, and at war with each other constantly, in which Jews were both pawns and allies, depending on who was fighting. Always the Pope lurked in the background. Italy and Sicily saw a share of anti-Jewish riots and pogroms, but most Italian Jews had something else as well, which was unique. That was acceptance and even prosperity. This prosperity coincided with and was facilitated by the Renaissance, which was essentially a lay Christian rebellion against the church and its dogmas and its narrow-mindedness. Began in the 14th century, the sophisticates of the Renaissance revisited the intellectual and aesthetic beauties of ancient Greece and Rome. So literature, art, music, in short, ideas generally became the focal point of people's lives. At its core, the Renaissance was anti-Pope, even to a certain extent anti-religion, as its proponents and moving forces resented the Pope's political and intellectual dominance, sometimes even tyranny. As the popes then were almost exclusively anti-Jewish, this despite and sometimes because of the split in the papacy after the Avignon Schism that had not yet been healed, the Renaissance really was a godsend for Jews. It was literally, as the word means, a rebirth. Non-Jews, broke free of the constraints, literary, artistic, and intellectual, of the church. And therefore, Jews were momentarily able to breathe and even to participate in the society at large at a cost that we'll discuss. Certainly the church was affected by this cultural phenomenon, although where they exercised control, Jews were still tormented. For example, in 1466, the Jews of Rome were forced to run around in races in front of jeering Christians during the Christian carnival before Lent. This in the Corso, one of the main streets in Rome. And this humiliation, forcing Jews to run for the amusement of Christians, continued for two centuries as an annual event. But there were great works of art that are admired until today that were commissioned by popes, and not only kings. So some of the popes, we'll see in a moment, especially those from the Medici family, they had a greater appreciation of art and the Renaissance. And intellectually, a new openness to the ideas of Torah emerged in parts of the Christian world. So in Italy, Jews became teachers of Hebrew, Tanakh, even Torah, to bishops, cardinals, and even the occasional pope. So the halachic propriety of teaching Torah to non-Jews was a heated rabbinical topic during those years, especially since a simple reading of the Talmud prohibits it. Among the renowned teachers of Torah was Rav Ovadia Sfarno, the great commentator on the Torah, plays a greater role in the next century. The Sfarno lived from 1470 to 1550. He taught Cardinal Domenico Grimani of Bologna, and the famous German humanist Johann Reuchlin taught both of them Hebrew and developed a very close relationship with both of them. Jews were welcomed into Renaissance society. Some Jews began writing poems and plays. Some even attended universities. Many others openly participated in academic discussions and conferences. Jews also served disproportionately as physicians in Italy, especially to the dukes, and even to some cardinals, and even a few popes had a Jewish doctor. And Torah study in a very limited sphere thrived as well. The Jews of Italy boasted such luminaries. The Gadol Hador, certainly in the latter part of the 15th century, Rabbi Yosef Kolon, the Maharik, was an extraordinary posek and communal leader, a descendant of Rashi. He was consulted in his Torah questions from across the globe. His student, Rav Avadya of Bartanura, 1440 to 1516, author of the famous commentary on the Mishnah. Bartanura eventually wound up in Yerushalayim. The aforementioned Rav Avadya Sarno, Rav Eliyahu of Ferrara, who made Aliyah, which was not uncommon amongst Italian Jews. He became the Rav in Yerushalayim in 1434. Rav Yehuda Messer Leon, the Rav of Mantua, later of Naples. Many scholars were also drawn to the study of Kabbalah, and Italian commentaries on the Torah most often had a Kabbalistic slant to it. Now, how did all this come about? For the most prosaic of reasons, in the intense competition between the city-states for economic supremacy, Jews were valued to a point for their money and skill and diplomacy, connections, their business acumen generally. The prosperity brought about, as well as the opening of the society, a weakening of the Jews' commitment to the observance of mitzvahs, a fact that was lamented by generations of Rabbanim there. The average person in Italy then, the average Jew, became more a patron of the arts than a denizen of the Beis Medrash. So the relative openness of the general society was a relief from the centuries of primitive Jew hatred, but it had two consequences. Our connection to Torah became more tenuous, and it spawned the inevitable backlash of the non-Jews. This was especially true in Florence. The first banking license was granted to Jews there in 1437. In due course, famous Jewish banking families, De Pisa, De Rieti, De Tavoli, moved to Florence, and they strengthened the existing Jewish community there. For the next half century, the fortunes of the Jews of Florence were soon, and really for a century or so after that, tied to those of the ruling Medici house. The wealthy Medici family had seized control of the Florence city-state in the early 1400s. The Medicis had natural ties to the Jewish bankers who settled in Florence, and the Medicis became their patrons and their protectors, especially against the heavy hand of the church. The aristocracy then was generally very supportive of the Jews when the local population, including the church officials, treated the Jews with hostility and contempt, the Medicis responded in force. They not only had money, they had power. When the local government was pressured to enact the traditional anti-Jewish measures, the Medicis usually were able to resist, not always, and therefore there was sporadic anti-Jewish violence in the 15th century, even in Italy. It was a half-hearted attempt to enforce the wearing of a yellow badge. It all depended on which priest, which bishop, which cardinal in any particular locale took power and how much he wanted to force the issue and how much the local population acceded to it. The authorities, though, consciously protected the Jews from the hatred that was fomented by the church and its preachers. Florence and its Jewish communities of 100 families flourished during the 15th century, especially during the rule of Lorenzo the Magnificent, Lorenzo il Magnifico, a name he gave himself, from 1469 to 1492. It was Lorenzo the Magnificent who transformed Florence into the most powerful city-state in Italy and one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And in this, he was aided by his banker, Yechiel ben Yitzchak of Pisa, who was the acknowledged leader of the Jewish community. Jews were especially active in the cultural and intellectual life of Lorenzo's Florence. Rav Eliyahu del Medigo was universally admired for his breadth of knowledge. Non-Jews frequently joined his discussions on philosophy, on Renaissance thought. In the spirit of the times, the Jews there wrote literature, wrote poetry, but no Torah works. And that was the downfall of the Florentine community. Indeed, no rabbis of any enduring reputation led the Florence community in the 15th century. By the late 15th century, a Christian middle class had grown that resented the success of the Jews. And the church additionally reasserted its authority over its own laity and the secular rulers by cracking down on whatever freedoms they had extended to the Jews. So hostile popes and anti-Jewish, rabidly anti-Jewish Dominican friars fanned the winds of the Inquisition blowing in from Spain. It's a blood libel in Trent in 1475. Several city-states expelled their Jewish residents in the 1480s, including Milan, including Florence as well for a short time, while Jews quickly found residence elsewhere. Their economic contributions were still welcomed, especially in Florence. So it was a situation where Jews were tossed out of one jurisdiction, another jurisdiction eagerly swept them up until the pressures grew there. But the die was cast. In fact, what came out was that the authorities desired the benefits of the Jews, but not the Jews themselves. And this would have harmful repercussions to Italian Jewry in the 16th century, when in fact their golden era would come to a very rapid conclusion. None of this, though, compares to the sorrows that afflicted Spanish Jewry in the 15th century. A catastrophe awaited them. That chilling event, the pogroms at the end of the 14th century, the massacres that took place in 1391, sparked by that fierce Jew-hating priest, Ferenc Martinez, shocked the Jewish world. The treatment of Spanish Jews, especially expulsion, was the chilling event of the 15th century and for many centuries before and really since. Thousands of Jews already fled Spain after 1391, and worse, as we noted last time, thousands more, for the first time in European Jewish history, converted en masse to Christianity. The numbers are in dispute, but it would seem that more Jews converted than fled for reasons we discussed. Again, Spanish Jews had adopted for themselves a Jewish lifestyle that involved a tepid connection to mitzvos, as well as an immersion in the philosophical trends of the time. So they weren't willing to give their lives for ideas. They weren't observing the mitzvos anyway. Those who remained, those and did not convert, they felt the harsh persecution of the Spanish authorities. They tasted the bitter fruits of unparalleled persecution, constant pressure to convert, economic pressures, forced sermons, the inability to lead a normal life. Conversos, those Jews that pretend to convert to Christianity, they would later feel the sting of the Inquisition, and the entire community was subject to another disputation. This one meant by the Christians to be the last one. To an extent, it was the last famous one, and that was at Tortosa in 1413. Like the famous disputation in Barcelona involving Ramban in 1263, this was also forced upon the Jewish leadership. It was also spearheaded by Jewish apostates, like the former Shlomo Halevi, now known as Paulus de Santa Maria, who was an ex-student of Rabbi Yehuda, the son of the Rosh, and a doctor, Yehoshua Halorki, known as Geronimo de Santa Fe. But unlike the Barcelona disputation and the Ramban, the Jewish participants here were really deprived of freedom of speech. Jewish audiences were forced to listen to the Torah mocked and ridiculed, and the Talmud and Torah distorted to prove, so to speak, the veracity of Jesus as the Messiah, with little response from the rabbis involved. That, in fact, was the game plan of the Christians, to take psukim from the Torah and words of the Talmud to make the Jews feel not only that Christianity is true, Rahman al-Islam, but that these rabbis had distorted their own religion in order to deny Jesus. Now, there report, some report that they acquitted themselves as best as they could, but in fact they were forced into long periods of silence, prevented from responding fully, and more. Ramban had fled Barcelona and therefore was able to publish an account of the disputation. Here at Tortosa, they could not flee, and in fact, they never fully published any account of what went on, leading the Christians to write the history, in their mind, a victory at Tortosa. And they were great and holy men who were forced to deal here with absolute rishon. The leading disputant was the famous Rabbi Yosef Albo, 1380 to 1444, famed author of the Sefer Ikarim. In a sense, he wrote the Sefer Ikarim as one of the consequences in order to reinforce the faith of the Jews. Rabbi Yosef Albo reduced the Rambam's 13 principles to three: the existence of God, Torah and Hashemayim, and Schar Onesh, reward and punishment, and that basically covers it all. He didn't disagree with the Rambam on any particular point, except to say that not every idea that the Rambam maintained was a Yesod, was in fact a Yesod. So for example, he maintained, he writes in the Sefer Ikarim, that belief in Mashiach is not one of the Ikarim. We believe in it, but it's not in him, but it's not one of the Ikarim. Now this is also a problem, because there are 14 Rabbonim, all told, who were brought by the Christians to Tortosa to debate, and they can always agree amongst themselves. For example, those who favored the Rambam's view maintain that belief in Bias HaMashiach is an Iker, it is a fundamental principle. Others said not. Since each had days which they responded, the message that was sent was not always monolithic, which itself was a problem. There's another grove, our Profiat Yitzchak Duran, the author of a commentary in the Morah called Haifodi. He was a skilled polemicist, and he participated so too of Astruk Halevi, who did most of the talking. So one of the midrashim that the Christians always use was brought up here as well. Rav Astruk Halevi was challenged to defend the Medrash that the Mashiach was born on the day of the Churban, which would seem to mean that Mashiach came and is long gone. So he first responded, well, if he was born on the day of the Churban, it couldn't be Jesus, who was born long before the Churban. But he responded to the Pope, Benedict XIII. We're only three popes past that Benedict, but Benedict XIII, who was in attendance, Rav Astruk Halevi said, and I quote, "You believe so many improbabilities about your Messiah, let us believe this simple one, this single one, regarding ours." But that was as acerbic as the Jews could get. Again, unlike the disputation at Barcelona that lasted 10 days in 1263, this droned on for 69 sessions held over the course of 16 months, in which the Rabbonim were basically imprisoned in Tortosa and could not return to their communities or have any contact with them. All the while, another militant Jew-hating priest, Vincente Ferrer, traveled through Jewish communities reporting on what was happening at Tortosa, and unfortunately, bereft of their rabbinical leadership, he succeeded in rounding up many, many converts, for that he later became St. Vincent, very well known. But in a sign of how diverse the threats were to the Jews, he vehemently opposed forced conversions. He was sincere in that sense. And he opposed physical persecution of Jews as anti-Christian. That was his shita. But nonetheless, he maintained that all Jews had to convert, but he wanted to talk us into it. Among the Jews listening live at Tortosa, many converted on the spot as well. It was an unmitigated disaster, and when the gallant rabbis refused to concede, the Pope abruptly declared an end after 16 months. No progress has been made. Pope Benedict XIII banned the study of the Talmud in Spain as a heretical document that was anyway being distorted by these rabbis. He barred Jews from many of the professions, this for a short amount of time. And he successfully impoverished the community, both spiritually and materially, and the great expulsion was yet 80 years away. Within two decades, more or less, two and a half decades from 1391, several hundred thousand Jews had converted to Christianity. Of them, a substantial number were insincere converts whose lives would vex themselves, the official Jewish community, and the Christians for more than a century. right after the disputation, the Pope interceded and stated that Jews who were converted in the act of protesting, that is to say, they were protesting while they're being baptized, they could revert to their Judaism, as opposed to those Jews who were converted under threat and intimidation, but did not utter any protest. When the pressure relented in the 1420s, Jews began to rebuild under the leadership of Rabbi Yitzhak Kanpantone, known as the Gaon of Castile, who founded the yeshiva there, the last great Gadol of Spanish Jewry, great Rosh Yeshiva, who taught Torah until his death in 1463. Now, many conversos tried to find their way back to the Jewish community, and for many, considered traitors, the road was barred. If the rabbis approved, the community leaders often did not. Numerous tshuvos were written about their status, about how they could rejoin the community, what they had to do, how to treat them if they rejoined, in fact, how to treat them if they moved abroad and wanted to rejoin the Jews there. Additionally, their relations with their newfound Christian brothers, so to speak, was even more strained. Conversos were always suspected of being insincere converts, or better said, almost all Jews who converted were suspected by the Christians of being insincere converts, so Christians were always on the lookout for signs of reversion to Jewish practice, watching the home to see if there was a fire burning on Shabbos, whether they fasted in Yom Kippur or worked on Shabbos or consumed poor or made the sign of the cross or knew the catechism or went to church, etc. Books were published in the 15th century describing ways that Christians could identify Jewish practices. There were conversos who would observe Shabbos in secret and then go to Mass on Sunday. It was a dual existence that became very hard to maintain. For example, since Mila, for their children, would easily identify themselves as Jews, they often did not circumcise their sons, and within a generation or two, even the covert Jewish practices or identity would fade. And all of this was before the Inquisition came to Spain in the 1480s and began to flush them out. It got so bad in the 1440s, conversos organized to defend themselves against Christian attacks because the Christians saw them as no different than Jews. And that beheld something more ominous and long-lasting. The conversos, who were no longer bound by the economic restrictions that other Jews were, entered Christian society and became connected and became prosperous. Merchants, landowners, government officials, even occasionally bishops and cardinals, and even tax collectors. This enraged the average Christian who still saw them as Jews. In turn, this Christian intolerance often angered the popes of all people who, after all, had sought the conversion of Jews. So they also were not on the same page. In Toledo, in 1449, an ordinance was passed barring any converso, that is, any person having Jewish blood, from holding public office. It was enforced, even though Pope Nicholas V excommunicated the author of the statute, because that statute opposed what he was trying to accomplish in converting the Jews. But all this meant had very far-reaching implications. After 14 centuries of viewing Jews as a member of a religion, that if the Christians played their cards right, Jews would abandon, or if they chose, or if they were coerced, for the first time Jews were defined as a race, and not just a religion, defined by blood. If you had Jewish blood, then even conversion could not make you a full Christian. This was the birth of the modern Jew hatred, the racial Jew hatred, that would eventually culminate in the Holocaust. Almost 90 years after this, in the 1530s, the Society of Jesus was founded. Those are known until today as the Jesuits. The Jesuits had one qualification. They were founded because the membership had to be based on pure blood. No Jewish blood for five generations in the family. The Jesuits who founded, it was Ignatius Loyola founded all these universities in America, Loyola, Fordham, Georgetown, etc. That was his founding principle. The people had to prove 5 generations free of any Jewish blood. That requirement would not be relaxed for at least another 4 centuries. Spanish, and it wasn't formally revoked, by the way, until after the Holocaust, when it had a bad taint to it. Spanish Christians began to distinguish between old Christians and those they called new Christians or conversos, and they refused to accept conversos as equals. It's very hard to convey the turbulence of Christian life in the 15th century in which Jews were victims, because Christian life really was wild. Jew hatred was now a witch's brew of race and religion. But the Christian world was generally in an uproar over the spread of a variety of heresies, some of them in the wake of the Black Death, some of them because of the corruption in the church. We mentioned before that Jan Hus had been burnt at the stake in 1415. 16 years later, Joan of Arc, after claiming divine visions and also challenging the ruling authority, she was also burnt at the stake. When Constantinople fell to the Muslims in 1453, that eastern vanguard of Christendom was gone. When that happened, the Muslims triumphed, Jews first rejoiced. And many Jews saw this as a harbinger of Bias Mashiach. Then already in the 1450s, Jews by the hundreds left Spain for Israel, the first real settlement there in centuries. At the same time, and this is part of the problem, the papacy was racked by the schism of Avignon and blatant, rampant corruption. The office was bartered, bought, and sold. The Medicis appointed their own family members as pope whenever they could, and otherwise they were a thorn in the side of the more fervent popes because they weren't that firm. It was a pope, Alexander VI, who took power in 1492. He was so open about his affairs and his children that he did not hesitate to make his own son a cardinal at the ripe young age of 18. That was the environment that existed throughout the Christian world. And all of this left a religious power vacuum. And the less religious popes prompted a backlash from the people, and that's why in Spain they're able to ignore the popes, and that gave rise to the final demise of Spanish Jewry. In 1469, to solidify relations between the two Spanish kingdoms, Aragon and Castile, King Ferdinand of Aragon married Queen Isabella of Castile, declared a united Spain with one overriding goal, as Isabella said, one king, one law, one faith. Of the two, he was a bit of a mercenary. He was not as religious as she was, but she was a zealous Catholic, known until today in Spain as Isabella la Católica. That's how she's known, because that was her prominence. And she determined to rid the country of Jews and Muslims by conversion or expulsion. And in fact, Ferdinand literally had to be schlepped along. Not that he's exempt from our criticism or rebuke, but she was the prime mover. In 1482, Isabella la Católica brought the Inquisition to Spain over the protests of the Pope, and the very next year, 1483, she designated her personal confessor, a Dominican priest named Tomás de Torquemada, as the chief inquisitor. Inquisition targeted sinning Catholics generally, and of course conversos, although usually not Jews, and they employed tactics that later became famous to us, infamous to us, by the Soviets. The widespread use of informants, for example, to ferret out sinners. Husbands and wives were encouraged to rat each other out. Children would inform on parents. They would arrest people arbitrarily and force them to confess, and in lieu of punishment, send them out into the society to try to find other Christian sinners. They would use torture to extract confessions, arbitrary punishments, including burnings and stonings, steep fines. Torquemada, it is said, had a Jewish background, But he was a Fabrenta priest. In that sense, he wasn't corrupt like so many of the Roman priests. He lived a very frugal, ascetic, monk's existence, and he was totally dedicated to his evil craft. He, Torquemada, specialized in the autos de fe, the acts of faith, public rituals of penance for sinners that would often end with their executions at the stake, of course, now cleansed of whatever sins they had. But tens of thousands of autos de fe conducted during his tenure, in which an estimated 13,000 conversos were killed and hundreds of thousands of Christians tormented as well. Jews suffered, and again, Jews were not targets necessarily of the Inquisition, but Jews suffered from more attempts at forced conversions and property confiscations, and in 1491, a ritual murder charge that is still famous today, the infamous case of the so-called Holy Child of LaGuardia near Toledo, in which a Christian boy disappeared, who was presumed dead. His body was never found, but the Christians alleged that his body and blood were used by the Jews. Several Jews were executed without any proof, of course, of anything, but the population was further inflamed. This is 1491, and all of this, of course, led to the next year's tragic and horrific events. In January of 1492, the city of Granada, the last Muslim stronghold in Iberia, was captured, and for the first time in 700 years, the Muslims were driven off the peninsula, the Reconquista, the reconquest of Spain, now complete. With that, with one religious group now gone, on March 31st, 1492, in the captured Alhambra Palace in Granada, Ferdinand and Isabella signed the Edict of Expulsion that gave Jews 4 months to convert or leave. The despair was enormous, but these two, proud of their work, known again until today as Reyes Católicos, the Catholic monarchs, they refused to be dissuaded. Indeed, Isabella became the first woman ever to appear on a U.S. coin. That's because of her sending of Columbus. And she is still up for sainthood in the Catholic Church. She's on the sainthood track even now. She was first beatified, I think it was 1994. One who tried to dissuade them was Don Yitzhak of Bravanel, who was born and raised in Portugal, the son of the finance minister to King Alfonso of Portugal. Don Yitzhak succeeded his father as the royal treasurer and as leader of the Jews of Lisbon until 1481, when Alfonso died, and Alfonso's son distrusted Bravanel, and he very quickly moved to Spain. He resigned from political life. He began writing his commentary on Novi until Ferdinand and Isabella brought him on board in 1484 to help finance their final campaign against the Muslims, in which he was very successful. Because of his success and their prosperity, he appealed to them on a personal level to annul the decree. They refused. They did grant him one thing, though. He was offered an exemption. He could stay in Spain if he wanted and not convert, but he refused, and Abravanel led his people into exile in the summer of 1492. As of Thursday, August 2nd, which was the 9th of Av, in 1492, it's a Thursday just like this year, no Jew could legally reside in Spain. In the months preceding, Jews were forced to sell their possessions for a pittance. Couldn't travel that much. Rabbis permitted the exiles to play music during the 3 weeks as we marched out of Spain to lift their spirits. About 200,000 Jews left Spain and thousands others converted, including the man who had been designated by those Reyes Católicos as the chief rabbi of Spain, Rav Avraham Senor. He converted as well. About 100,000 of the 200,000, about half, went to Portugal to live, where just 5 years later, King Manuel of Portugal expelled them too. Jews left Spain by land, trudging across France to the Netherlands and points north and east, but in much larger numbers traveled by ship to Italy and Turkey and some to Israel as well. Some of these ships sank. In fact, Jews by the thousands died en route to their new homes. Other ships were raided by pirates, and the Jews left destitute. Abravanel himself relocated to Naples, where he continued to write. At first, he wrote three works about redemption, about Gaul in the late 1490s, that are still extant, beautiful works, Ma'ina HaYeshua, Yeshua's Mashicho, and Mashmir Yeshua, all to reinvigorate his brethren. And then he went back to writing and finished his commentaries on Torah and on Tanakh. And again, he was a very talented individual. He was later impressed into public service in Venice. And there he died in 1508, buried in nearby Padua. It was by the sheer enormity of the disruption in Jewish life. The expulsion was the worst tragedy since the Churban. Jews had been expelled from many countries and places, but always came back, and never from a country where they had achieved such prominence, and for such a long time, over seven centuries, stability. And yet, it happened, and Jewish life was forever scarred, again, like we were by the Crusades, and certainly by the Churban. Of course, without the Jews, Spain began its decline, a very steep decline, within a century, especially after the defeat of the Spanish Armada at the hands of a smaller British fleet in 1588, Spain became and continues to be a third-rate power. And where the Jewish exiles went, especially Italy, they were not always welcomed by the native Jewish population, sad to say. And there were many chuvos that were written harshly critical of the communities. Turkish Jewry were more open, but Italian Jews, not necessarily so. It was one other interesting event on that day, 1492. As we know, Christopher Columbus sailed for the Americas on the morning after the expulsion, Friday, August 3rd, the 10th of Av, leaving the harbor in Seville with numerous ships that were carrying Jews elsewhere. Now there's credible evidence, credible stories persist that Columbus was a converso. I discussed this once at greater length in Shul. He was born in Genoa of a family named Colon. Cristobal Colon was his original name. Colon, of course, is a very famous Italian Jewish family, like the Marik was a Colon. He didn't have any real religious tradition that Christians knew about. Certain indications, he was versed in Hebrew for some reason. He was always recording the Hebrew year in his logs. There are many indications of a Jewish background. Both Abravanel and another Jew, Luis de Santangel, were financiers of Columbus's mission. Interestingly, Isabella had turned Columbus down on Torquemada's advice, but Ferdinand persisted, and for a short time at least, he reaped the benefits of Columbus's discoveries. It was one other 15th century event that would forever transform Jewish life, unexpectedly so, for the better, in what one American magazine termed the most important invention of the second millennium. I'm referring to the printing press. In 1439, Johann Gutenberg invented the printing press with movable type. That meant it was capable of mass producing papers, books, etc. So his first work was a Bible, but within a very short time, Jews realized its dual significance. First, by the 1470s, Jews were publishing Sidurim, Chumashim, other works. The very first Jewish sefer published by printing press was a Chumash and Rashi in 1474. Italy became the capital of Jewish publishing. One famous family in one famous town, Sansino, in northern Italy, that still exists. They produced the first volume of the Talmud in 1484, Maseches Brachos, of course, the first volume, the first tractate. But printing presses were established across Europe, from Krakow to London, Stockholm, and throughout Italy, and it was revolution. And it changed Jewish life because it not only made Torah knowledge easier to disseminate, but it stripped the Christians of one tool in their arsenal, and that was book burning. it didn't pay anymore. There'd be one more bout of book burning in the 1550s, but it didn't work because books were too easy to reprint. Just run off another 100, another 1,000 copies if someone made a bonfire. What the Christians then did, and subsequent despots as well, including in the Soviet Union and really in China today, in their own spheres, was to deny Jews control over the presses. Jews could not own printing presses by church law in the 15th or the 16th centuries. In the 16th century, printing became a Christian business with very heavy Jewish involvement. So just to sum up, the 15th century saw the end of the period of the Rishonim. The last Rishonim, the Gaonim of Ashkenaz, like the Maril, the Trumas Hadeshen, and the Marik in Spain, the last great leaders of Ashkenaz in Spain as well, but also saw the tormenting of Jews across the globe with massacres and blood libels and expulsions, the agonizing collapse of Spanish Jewry with a disputation at Tortosa, culminating in the great expulsion of 1492. Already, the center of Jewish life had shifted to Italy with the Marik and to Turkey. The great Posek of Eliyahu Mizrahi wrote a super commentary on Rashi's commentary on the Gemara. And those communities would now find new scholars in their midst from the Golei Sfarad, like the Radvaz, who went to Egypt and became the leading rabbi and dayan there, as well as someone else, a Spanish exile who was all of 4 years old in 1492 when he left Toledo with his family, moved to Turkey where he learned Torah, came to Eretz Israel, to Tzfat, where he, Rav Yosef Karo, would write the Shulchan Aruch and revolutionize Jewish life. And Columbus went to America, and that would become a refuge for Jews a century and a half later. The Hashgacha operates in such a way we see in century after century. One door closes and another door opens. So when we suffer and we're knocked down, even brutalized, we rise up, we reassess, we rebuild, and we continue to teach Torah and to serve Hashem in new locations, but always with new challenges ahead in the 16th century as well. I thank you all very much.